Welcome to the Internal Medicine Grand Rounders podcast. My name is Dick Wardrop, and I'm a MedPeds clinician educator, program director, and hospitalist at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. We are so proud to host another great episode of our cleverly titled podcast that gives you all you might expect out of a high-quality, evidence-based medicine Grand Rounds, right at your fingertips and right in your ears. Our program is funded by a grant from the Cleveland Clinic Education Institute, but the views expressed herein are not necessarily the views of Cleveland Clinic. Format of our production is very simple. We host world-class clinical experts in a variety of specialties in internal medicine and put forth important and high-impact clinical questions related to the practice of general medicine with impact for providers at all levels of medicine, including students, APPs, generalists, and seasoned veterans alike. Today's topic is celiac disease, and today we have an absolutely wonderful episode planned. I'm pleased to introduce our panel of distinguished guests. First is our resident content expert, Dr. Caitlin Payne. She's a stellar member of our PGY3 class, and as she nears graduation, she is preparing for her GI fellowship at Tufts University. Our second expert guest today is David Gardinier, an IBD and celiac dietitian in the Center for Human Nutrition at Cleveland Clinic. Finally, our staff physician expert, Dr. Claire Jansen-Odell, joins us from the Department of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at Cleveland Clinic. She is also an assistant professor of medicine at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine and Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. She is a prized member of our internal medicine residency program faculty, mentor to many, and a world's expert in celiac disease. To our honored guests, please take a moment to say hi, tell us about yourselves, and then we'll start into the questions.
Thanks, Dr. Wardrop. This is Caitlin. As he mentioned, I am a third-year internal medicine resident at Cleveland Clinic, and I'll be starting GI fellowship in Boston at Tufts this summer. So I'm really excited to be here, and especially I'm excited to have a chance to interview my research mentor, Dr. Jansen-Odell, on one of my absolute favorite topics, both personally and professionally. So I myself was diagnosed with celiac disease in my early 20s, and I had to learn how to navigate that big lifestyle change comes with being on a gluten-free diet and dealing with a chronic illness. And then in medical school, I became interested in celiac disease from a more academic standpoint, how it blends gastroenterology, immunology. I think it's a really common and under-recognized disease, and sort of having celiac disease, I've met a lot of other people with celiac disease, and I feel like as a population, lay people don't fully understand what it is. And I think even internists don't necessarily feel comfortable entirely with the workup or management. So I'm excited to talk to Dr. Jansen-Odell today.
I'm Claire Jansen-Odell. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm very excited to be here and share the stage with Caitlin, who I mentor on celiac research. I first got interested in celiac disease actually when I was an undergraduate. I took an electron microscopy course in college, and I was randomly assigned the small intestine. They were giving out organs in our lab, and the person next to me got the heart, the one on the other side got the kidneys. I got the small intestine, and it ended up being a life-changing event for me. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen, how the structure leads to the function that we see, and I think it's a very overlooked area of the GI tract, probably because we can't reach it as easily with a scope. But it is so important, and it is the hotspot for celiac disease. So I'm happy to be here today talking about what has been a passion of mine for a long time.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. My name is David. I am an IBD and celiac dietitian with about 2 years of experience at the Cleveland Clinic, and I work with our Cleveland Clinic Center for Celiac Disease to help patients kind of help follow a gluten-free diet for celiac disease. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, thank you all. I'll start with the first question. Quite simply, for some of our listeners, they may have not gotten to this in medical school, or they may just be curious and not in medicine. What is celiac disease?
Celiac disease is an immune-mediated condition that occurs in genetically susceptible individuals when they ingest or eat dietary gluten. What happens with celiac disease is that damage occurs to the villi in the small intestine and leaves them flattened, reducing the surface area for absorption. This can create a number of symptoms for patients with celiac disease, some that are more extreme and some that are actually quite subtle.
And how common is celiac disease, actually?
Celiac disease is thought to be in about 1% of the general population. Certain conditions have higher rates of celiac disease, but when we're talking on a population-based level, that's the number that we quote most often from our epidemiologic studies, about 1% here in the U.S.
That seems like a lot more than I would expect. And I guess one thing I'm curious about is, so whenever you hear about celiac disease, I think that kind of goes hand in hand with gluten and the gluten-free diet. So can you kind of explain a little bit, just briefly, what is gluten and why can't people with celiac disease eat it?
This is a very good question. Gluten is the storage protein found in wheat. It's responsible for giving dough its elastic texture and is an additive in a number of different foods. So why people with celiac disease can't eat gluten is because that's the antigen in celiac disease, the causal agent that leads to damage in the small intestine and the mucosa of the small intestine. Interestingly, there are similar proteins that create an immunologic effect in barley and rye as well. So while barley and rye don't actually contain gluten, they have a similarly structured protein that creates issues and an immunogenic response for patients with celiac disease.
And what's the difference between celiac disease and other forms of gluten sensitivity?
Importantly, celiac disease causes damage to the small intestine. Other forms of gluten sensitivity, like non-celiac gluten sensitivity, don't cause that same tissue damage, which can result in malabsorption. So in patients who have non-celiac gluten sensitivity, for example, they may not feel very good when they eat gluten and may have a whole variety of symptoms, but it doesn't actually damage their small intestine and their surface area for absorption. So we don't have to worry about their vitamin levels. We don't have to worry about bone health, nutritional deficiencies like we do in celiac disease.
Given all that you've said about gluten, I hear a lot in the lay press and on social media, for instance, about recommending gluten-free diets for other health conditions. As general internists or as hospitalists or as specialists, should we be recommending a gluten-free diet for other health conditions or for people without celiac disease?
The short and easy answer to that question is no, we shouldn't be recommending it. A gluten-free diet is appropriate for patients with celiac disease and necessity. It can be helpful for patients with non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and it's also important for patients with a wheat allergy. But is kind of a general healthy lifestyle recommendation? No, we do not recommend the gluten-free diet. And that's because a lot of the gluten-free foods have higher fat, salt, and sugar content than gluten-containing alternatives. And this means that these patients can have higher cholesterol levels, higher rates of diabetes, and other health conditions that we might see as a downstream effect of following a gluten-free diet. But I hear what you're saying. It's definitely popularized by some athletes as a part of a healthier lifestyle. But in general, we don't make that recommendation for people unless they have celiac disease or one of the wheat-related conditions I spoke of before.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about what is celiac disease, what is gluten. So I want to transition into a case that would be kind of typical of a person coming into clinic. So you have a 60-year-old woman who is evaluated in her primary care clinic for iron deficiency anemia. She was noted to have a hemoglobin of 10 on routine lab work, and follow-up iron studies showed low iron, high TIBC, and low transferrin saturation, which is consistent with iron deficiency anemia. She has no melena, no hematochezia, and her bowel movements are normal and regular. On review of systems, only notable findings are fatigue and occasional eczema on her elbows. She's referred to GI clinic for an EGD and colonoscopy to assess for possible occult GI bleeding leading to her iron deficiency anemia. On her EGD, her duodenum is noted to appear scalloped. Biopsies are obtained, which eventually reveal villous blunting and intraepithelial lymphocyte. So I'm going to transition into the next part of the interview. So Dr. Jansen-Nodell, how does celiac disease usually present, and what are the symptoms that people typically display?
Excellent question, Caitlin. When we think of gastrointestinal manifestations of celiac disease, we often think of epigastric pain, diarrhea, bloating, just a generalized discomfort. There can also be a number of extraintestinal manifestations. And I'm really glad that you brought up a case that would be considered non-classical, because there are so many symptoms associated with celiac disease. Unexplained weight loss can be seen. In younger individuals, we may see growth failure. Patients can have more of an irritable bowel syndrome type picture. Abnormal elevations in liver biochemistries. There can be all sorts of different conditions. I had one patient, in fact, who her only presenting symptom was oral aphthous ulcers. Her primary care doctor astutely checked a TTG and it was sky high. And to be honest with you, when I saw her in clinic and evaluated her, I thought, you know, I'm not quite sure what your biopsies are going to show. Like, this could be just an elevated TTG in the setting of another autoimmune condition. It could be a false positive. And I was just blown away when her biopsies showed MARSH 3 and were consistent with celiac disease. They showed villous atrophy. They showed the increased intraepithelial lymphocytes. And her only symptom, her one and only symptom, was the aphthous ulcers. So it's very interesting, and we really need to keep an open mind that patients with celiac disease can have just about anything. Patients with celiac disease can even have constipation, which seems unusual for a malabsorptive condition where we typically be seeing diarrhea. So many GI symptoms, a number of extraintestinal manifestations. There's no typical way that celiac disease presents. It's a wide variety.
Thank you for that comprehensive answer. I'm also a pediatrician, and recently in undergoing maintenance of certification questioning, had a question presented about the diagnosis of celiac disease. And I found myself using the resources available for that test to make sure that I understood the sequence. From what you've said, it sounds like there's a significant delay in diagnosis oftentimes, and so the index of suspicion would seem to need to be high for generalists and specialists alike. But for the audience today, how is celiac disease actually diagnosed?
Wonderful question. I'm so glad you asked. Currently, how we diagnose celiac disease is through a combination of both a blood test. So the serology test is the tissue transglutaminase IgA. And this has to be done when a patient is on a gluten-containing diet, and it has to be done in the context of this person having a normal total IgA level. So you're actually ordering two labs when you're looking for celiac disease, the total IgA and the tissue transglutaminase IgA. A biopsy is also required for the diagnosis of celiac disease, and this biopsy needs to have characteristic findings, including both villous changes like villous blunting, villous atrophy. The pathologist will make some comment like that, along with the increased intraepithelial lymphocytes. So for diagnosis, currently, we're doing a combination of serology and biopsy.
And I heard you mention that for the lab tests, the patient has to be already on a gluten-containing diet. So I'm wondering, what if my patient has already started a gluten-free diet? Maybe they noticed that they were having symptoms associated with gluten, then they come to clinic. How do we evaluate those patients for celiac disease if they are already gluten-free?
That's a great question, Caitlin, and I'm so glad you asked, because we do see a number of patients like that who have recognized that something in their diet is causing them not to feel good and have taken it out. Unfortunately, the positive predictive value of removing gluten from the diet for celiac disease is very low, only around 30%. So just by eliminating gluten and feeling better, this is not enough. We need the formal testing to be done. And if we want to avoid a false negative test, we need the testing to be done when the person is not limiting gluten in their diet in any way. So a lot of times I will have that conversation with my patients. And if a patient is very resistant about reintroducing gluten, we'll start with a genetic test to see if they have HLA-DQ2 or DQ8, one of the required alleles in order to develop celiac disease. If they don't, that negative predictive value is so high, we really don't need to be evaluating them for celiac disease. But if they do, and it's important to know that about 30% of the population carries one of these alleles, then we move forward with formal gluten challenge or a gluten holiday, if you will, where the patient should not be limiting gluten in any way and, in fact, actively work to eat some gluten so that this testing can be accurate. And after a period of time, then we would do the serology and the upper endoscopy with biopsies.
I think that's really important to remember because at least on the internal medicine side of things, I've definitely seen this a lot of times where patients maybe don't think to go to the doctor right away. They just, you know, they're trying to feel better on their own. So they start elimination diet and it can be such a diagnostic challenge once they've already gone gluten-free. So, you know, I think if we see patients in the primary care fields, just reminding them like if they have any suspicion that they might have celiac disease or a gluten sensitivity, just to get that antibody testing. It's so easy, you know, before they go gluten free. Okay, so then I guess that kind of leads into my next question. So for maybe not a GI doctor, but an internist or primary care doctor, when should I be ordering this celiac disease antibody testing? And what kind of patient should I be considering celiac disease in my differential?
Excellent question. Because the symptoms are so variable, this is something that's important to think about. I would consider ordering celiac disease antibody testing when patients are coming in with GI complaints and a wide variety of GI complaints. This includes epigastric pain, diarrhea, even constipation, like I mentioned earlier. Iron deficiency anemia is a key one, as well as unintended weight loss. Sometimes even symptoms like nausea merit celiac disease testing as well. So I'm keeping an open mind as far as GI symptoms go. It's a screening test. It's very easy, simple blood work. I'm testing many of my patients with GI concerns for celiac disease. Those with associated conditions, like type 1 diabetes, for example, Down syndrome, thyroid disease, this is another group where I'm having a little bit of a higher index of suspicion and checking those patients for celiac disease. And importantly, if someone has a family history, a first-degree family member with celiac disease, it is a guideline recommendation to check them for celiac disease, even if they are asymptomatic. So I really emphasize this in my clinic to my newly diagnosed celiac patients that they need to inform their family and encourage them to be screened as well. Any parents they have that are still living, any children they have, as well as siblings. So these are the groups that I'm thinking about celiac disease testing for.
Great. Okay, so somebody's coming into clinic, you've tested them for celiac antibodies for whatever reason, and they're positive. So they have a positive TTG-IGA. Do they really need a biopsy at this point? I guess I'm wondering what is the sensitivity, the specificity for the TTG testing?
Good question. Currently, we are still recommending biopsy for all patients, although research is ongoing because in some children, select groups of children, those with a tissue transglutaminase greater than 10 times the upper limit of normal, they are recommending a no biopsy approach. Currently for adults, though, everyone still needs a biopsy to be diagnosed with celiac disease. The sensitivity and specificity of TTG testing is felt to be about 95% for both of those parameters. And we know that this test performs well in both referral and primary care-based settings. But we're still requiring biopsy for diagnosis just because it provides that extra bit of information. And there are a number of different conditions that can present as villous atrophy that we should also consider that aren't celiac disease.
So that leads me into my next question. On the flip side, if someone has an EGD and they have duodenal biopsies and the pathology shows that they have villous blunting and intraepithelial lymphocytes, is it sufficient to say that they have celiac disease? I think I heard you mention that it's not and there are some other conditions that can mimic.
That's correct, Caitlin. So there are a number of other conditions that cause villous atrophy in the duodenum. And these are infections, including Giardia, Whipple disease, for example. But there are also concerns about medications and other conditions like autoimmune enteropathy, Crohn's disease, eosinophilic enteritis, graft versus host disease, and HIV-associated enteropathy. So there are a number of other different things that we have to keep our eye out for and that have a completely different management strategy than celiac disease. So before we commit patients to a strict lifelong gluten-free diet, We'd like to be sure of the diagnosis. And that's why even if you see the villus blontin and the intraepithelial lymphocytes on the duodenal biopsy, you still need the serology testing to confirm their diagnosis.
Thank you for clarifying this. And I think one of the challenges for most physicians is now that we've diagnosed this unusual disease in our practice from, in this case, antibody testing and pathology from the duodenum, what do we need to do besides put a patient on a gluten-free diet?
There's a lot more to the care for patients with celiac disease besides just starting the gluten-free diet. The gluten-free diet is not easy, and they need to be referred to a registered dietitian for their expertise. And that's why I'm so glad that David is here with us today, and we're going to get to him for some questions and his expertise later. We're all looking forward to that. But they need to have longitudinal follow-up. They should be followed by a gastroenterologist. And the timeline that I like to tell them about is we're first going to see improvement in your symptoms as you start the gluten-free diet. Then we expect to see your serology or the blood test normalize. And eventually, we expect to see your small intestine heal when you've eliminated gluten and you're able to absorb like you should. So for these patients, we monitor not just how they're doing clinically, but also from a lab standpoint, including some basic nutritional labs at their time of diagnosis, an assessment of their bone health with a DEXA scan, discussion with their family members about getting screened for celiac disease, and other health maintenance issues like vaccination, which we also review with them.
And besides, so, you know, we talked about the gluten-free diet. Are there any medications available for celiac disease, or are there any other treatments or, you know, future directions for treatments besides this diet?
Great question, Caitlin, and one that we often get asked by our patients. At this point in time, there are no FDA-approved medications for the treatment of celiac disease. The only treatment right now is the gluten-free diet, but there are a number of drugs in development right now that help with digesting gluten or that mitigate the damage to the small intestine that occurs with gluten. So stay tuned because there are a number of studies looking at this very area. But at this point in time, many are promising, but none have FDA approval.
All right. I think for the next phase of our show, we're going to flip the script. So I will leave it to Dr. Jansen Nodell to interview our resident expert, Caitlin, as a patient with celiac disease.
Wonderful. Caitlin, you have a very unique perspective here. Not only are you a physician, but you are also a patient with celiac disease. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about your experience with that. So I'd like to start out with, how did you find out you had celiac disease?
Yeah, thank you for asking. This is something, you know, I talk about celiac disease a lot. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, this is a very visible disease. Unlike some other medical conditions, it's something that, you know, you end up having to talk about pretty much every day of your life because it involves a diet, a strict diet, and food is an important part of life. So I talk about my celiac disease a lot, whether I want to or not. So I think most of us who have this disease are pretty used to, you know, making light of it and discussing it. And I think, you know, that's a good thing. It kind of destigmatizes it. So I thought that I had celiac disease incidentally, actually. I was 22 and I had an upper endoscopy done for acid reflux symptoms that I'd had for a few years. So I'd seen a GI doctor for that. We just went to take a look. And when I was waking up from the anesthesia, I remember him sitting on my bed saying, "Your duodenum looks terrible. You have scalloping and I'm almost sure you have celiac disease, but we have to wait for the pathology results. So I'll call you in about a week, you know, go gluten-free." And I remember being very shocked by that. And, you know, I had heard of celiac disease before. I had a couple of friends who had it, but it was not on my radar as something that I could have. You know, I did not have GI symptoms other than, of course, the reflux, which turned out to be unrelated. I still have reflux even when I went gluten-free. And then, you know, a week later, the pathology confirmed that I had celiac disease. And it's interesting because looking back, I did have symptoms of celiac disease. For many years, I'd been iron deficient anemic. I'd been on iron supplements for many years. Around that same time that I developed iron deficiency, I had lost weight, probably about 7 or 10% of my body weight, actually, without trying. I also was having a lot of emotional lability around that same time. I would just have like random outbursts of crying and I didn't know why. I'd actually seen my pediatrician for all of those symptoms. And I think they just all chalked it up to teen angst and put me on an iron supplement. So, you know, it's interesting because I got diagnosed after 4 years of symptoms and it was not even on purpose. I found it looking at something different. So yeah, that's how I found out.
Caitlin, thank you for sharing that. Your story is so interesting in that a lot of my patients come to me and tell me something similar and that they had been having symptoms for a while or complaining of a certain thing for a while or concerned about a particular symptom for a while, and celiac disease just wasn't really thought of. So it's really important, like we mentioned earlier, to keep a very open mind about what celiac disease could look like. And in your case, with the iron deficiency and the weight loss, some of these are a little bit of what we tend to think of as more classical symptoms or signs of malabsorption. You know, your small intestine wasn't working like it should have, and you couldn't get the iron that you needed, and you couldn't keep on weight. You were losing weight. But it was tricky to make that diagnosis. So I'm glad you shared that with everyone. And I wanted to follow with another question, which you've told us a little bit about, mentioning how it's very visible, but how does celiac disease affect your daily life?
Yeah, so I think, you know, for me, there are sort of two main components of celiac disease that I have to think about every day, or people with celiac have to think about. And that's, you know, number one, the diet and food, and then number two, symptoms. So I am very fortunate in that my symptoms are well controlled on a gluten-free diet. And this is not something that I have to think about very often. You know, I didn't have classic GI symptoms when I was diagnosed. Now I have a very like acute, sort of almost like very acute inflammatory response. If I were to eat a loaf of bread, I would get like intensely nauseous, basically like food poisoning. But fortunately, that doesn't happen very often. And I don't feel super sick if I get small amounts of cross-contamination. So I am very lucky in that respect. And there are many patients with celiac disease who are not so lucky, who have to think about feeling sick very often. So for me, celiac disease really affects me by my diet and the foods I have to eat, which I think I'm going to talk about a little bit more in maybe your next few questions. But, you know, this is something I have to think about all the time. Sometimes it's easier and sometimes it's harder, depending on if, you know, I'm eating at home, if I'm eating out, if I'm traveling. But the gluten-free diet is really the major change to my life.
And Caitlin, what has been the easiest part of going gluten-free?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's, and I think David's going to talk about this a little bit more, but, you know, the visibility of gluten, it has really improved over the last maybe 10 or 15 years. You know, I have friends who were diagnosed with celiac disease in the 90s who had a lot harder time finding gluten-free products. I find that if I'm in a grocery store, for example, it is easy. It is easy to find foods that I know are safe. You know, there's a learning curve here, of course, but, you know, the fact gluten is in wheat, and then, you know, the related protein in barley and rye. So, you know, any sort of vegetable, fruit, you know, produce, you know, meats, as long as they're not seasoned or something, you know, are just naturally gluten-free. So that's easy enough to find. And then any sort of, you know, packaged product, snacks or sauces or whatnot, are pretty, you know, these days it's pretty easy to find labels. So there's a gluten-free label that I think David might mention later on that I have gotten really good at finding. So I know how to find that label on packaging. So if that label is on it, I know I'm safe. Additionally, I know if a product says gluten-free on it, that I know that I'm safe. And then even if the product doesn't have dye that actually says gluten-free, I know how to read ingredients now and look for, you know, wheat will be a labeled allergen. So if it says wheat, I know I can't eat it. A little harder with the barley and the rye, you know, having to learn about some of these buzzwords that might contain gluten. So for example, malt is a barley product. It's not labeled under allergens, but I know that I can't eat that. So I think, you know, there's a learning curve here, of course, but now that I've had celiac disease for quite some time, I'm pretty good at reading labels. And I think that cooking from home is not too difficult. So I would say that's the easiest.
And what do you think the hardest part is of going gluten-free?
Yeah. So I think sort of in contrast to going to the grocery store, I think going to restaurants is very difficult with celiac disease. So, you know, while There are regulations on packaged products about what the term gluten-free means. The restaurants don't have that same sort of restriction. So if I go to a restaurant and something on the menu says gluten-free or GF, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is. So I think, you know, having to learn how to navigate ordering at restaurants and also whether or not that is a safe thing to do. You know, I think the only way you know for sure you're going to be eating gluten-free at a restaurant is if the restaurant has a certified gluten-free kitchen and they don't even allow gluten into their kitchen. Those are obviously rare. So maybe you go to a restaurant that maybe isn't completely gluten-free. Some celiacs won't eat there because they'll feel sick or they don't feel comfortable. Other people with celiac, like myself, you know, have decided that you have to maintain some level of quality of life too. And I accept a degree of possible cross-contamination so that I can continue to live my life. So, you know, something might be labeled gluten-free, but then I have to ask the waiter, you know, is that fried in the same oil as something with gluten? Or do you use the same stovetop? So like if you get a like gluten-free burger, you know, with a gluten-free bun, they might toast that bun in the same toaster as they toast regular bread. And you have to kind of decide whether or not, if it is, it's worth taking that risk. And so for me, honestly, it depends. I think most of the time I'm pretty good about avoiding as much cross-contamination as possible. I'll avoid things that are fried in the same oil or cooked on the same counter. But as I mentioned before, like, you know, I have to keep living life. So sometimes I will accept that risk. And I am fortunate that I don't get sick from small amounts of cross-contamination. And I get my TTG levels checked every year. They have now normalized, and I've had multiple follow-up endoscopies, which have showed that I've had duodenal healing. So, you know, for me, that's sort of a risk I'm willing to accept. But, you know, sometimes I go back and forth. I think, you know, it's hard to know whether that's the right thing to do or whether I'm potentially causing, you know, small amounts of harm by eating at restaurant. So, you know, there's like a psychological component of this. And I think there's a lot of people with celiac disease who get kind of afraid, and they have to sort of figure out how they're going to eat in a way that's safe for them, you know, psychologically, but also physically.
That's so interesting, Caitlin. And also, we've been to a restaurant together. And I must say, you made it look so easy and like you were very relaxed about things. And I could tell that you've definitely had years of experience doing this. But I was just really impressed with how you approached it. And
I'll tell you too that like it was hard. It was a lot harder when I was younger. I think when I was, you know, I was diagnosed when I was 22, and I did not ever want to cause a scene at a restaurant, or, you know, I was never the person to sort of ask to talk to the chef or something. But, you know, as I've dealt with this, I've gotten more comfortable with that and caring a little bit less about what people think or what they might, you know, I've had a variety of reactions and knowledge from waiters about celiac disease and being gluten-free, and honestly, some judgment as well. But I've learned to not worry too much about that anymore. But it is definitely a learning curve.
Indeed. So my final question for you is, what do you wish other people, family, friends, even strangers, if you want, understood about celiac disease?
Yeah. You know, I could talk about this a lot, but I think one big thing is that celiac disease is not just gluten intolerance. It is an autoimmune disease and it's a chronic illness. You know, I mentioned that I had years of evidence of malabsorption. I also have autoimmune thyroid disease. And so, you know, I worry about this disease as a risk factor for potential other autoimmune diseases in my future. So I think sometimes people kind of write this off. It's just like, oh, you're just gluten intolerant. But I think celiac disease is more than that. And even if you are just gluten intolerant, I don't think we should stigmatize that. But I've had a lot of judgment, and I've had people like roll their eyes at me when I say I need to eat gluten free, you know, or just kind of question why I have to be so strict. Or sometimes I've had to send food back at a restaurant because there's clearly, you know, croutons in the salad or something. And I know that can make people uncomfortable sometimes. So I wish people kind of took it more seriously and recognized that there's more to it than just, you know, this is just, you know, it makes your tummy hurt or something. We know that celiac disease, patients with celiac are more likely to get various types of infections because of, you know, functional asplenia. We know, you know, we're more likely to have osteoporosis and damage to bones. So I think that's the main thing, that I just wish people took it more seriously.
David, thank you for joining us. And I would like to ask you, from your standpoint, what is gluten and what foods is gluten found in?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Gluten is a mixture of proteins found in the grains wheat, barley, and rye. It's found in foods made from these grains, like breads, pasta, crackers, pretzels, other bakery products like brownies, cookies, cakes. It's also an ingredient, gluten, that's used in a variety of processed foods. So it can be really found in any food if the manufacturer is using it for its binding properties or for its texture properties. Finally, gluten is often found in oats, which are a naturally gluten-free grain, but due to the high rate of cross-contact between oats and other gluten-containing grains during the growing and processing of oats, sometimes gluten will be found there as well.
So that sounds like it's a lot of foods. So what does a gluten-free diet entail?
Yeah, it is a lot of foods. And a gluten-free diet involves avoiding dietary ingestion of gluten, you know, whether that's through direct consumption of those gluten-containing grains like wheat, rye, or barley, or, you know, indirect consumption of these grains, you know, when they're used as ingredients in other foods. And so a gluten-free diet really just entails avoiding gluten in all of its forms throughout the diet.
So, David, how strict does the gluten-free diet have to be in people with celiac disease?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one I often get from patients. As far as the strictness of this gluten-free diet, for celiac disease, we recommend that the diet be very strict. There's not really a safe amount of gluten that we recommend people with celiac disease consume, and so we recommend that they avoid it as best that they possibly can. You know, I think it's unrealistic to say that somebody with celiac disease is never going to have gluten again in their life, because there is this, you know, high prevalence of gluten throughout the diet. It's in a bunch of different foods. But we often tell them just to do the best that they can to avoid it in really any form possible.
And how do people with celiac disease know if something is gluten-free?
That's a really good question. You touched on it a little bit earlier. There's a lot of different areas on the food label that patients can look to try to identify or find if the food will be gluten-free. So first off, there's that FDA standard that says that any food that has the statement gluten-free on it must comply to that less than 20 parts per million gluten rule. And so if something says gluten-free, oftentimes I say, you know, for patients with celiac disease, that is a good option. Now, there's also, in addition to this FDA standard, there's also these third-party certifications. One of them is the Gluten-Free Certification Organization, or GFCO, and that is where patients can sometimes see what I would call like the little circle with a GF in it, or nowadays they're moving to this kind of squiggly G that says certified gluten-free. That's more of an icon that indicates that this product has been tested by this third-party organization. And I believe their standard is actually less than 10 parts per million gluten, so a little bit stricter than what the FDA has. Other places that patients can look are on that contained statement. Like you mentioned, wheat is an allergen. And so if there is a wheat-containing ingredient in a packaged food, it must be listed under that contained statement along with other allergens like soy, milk or dairy, eggs, and similar. So that's another one. Like you mentioned, barley and rye are not allergens. So technically, if there is a barley-containing ingredient in the food, such as malt, it will not be listed under that contained statement. And then finally, really the last place that we recommend patients look is just the ingredients list, looking out for wheat, rye, barley, and any ingredients derived from these grains, such as malt, would be the final place to look on packaged foods.
And David, if you see a patient in clinic who is just diagnosed with celiac disease, how do you counsel them on the gluten-free diet?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Because a lot of the times it's a very big change, especially a dietary change for these newly diagnosed patients. And so the first step that I normally do is I kind of educate as far as learning how to avoid. And the big part is replace gluten-containing foods and ingredients in the diet. I kind of teach them where to find maybe some of those sneaky sources of gluten, stuff like red licorice that, you know, the average person just isn't really thinking about when they think about a food that could possibly contain gluten. I teach them how to avoid cross-contact with gluten, both within their home and also when they are dining out. Like you mentioned, that could be an area that is specifically difficult And so I try to give them the tools and resources needed to make that transition as easily as possible. The last thing I do is I kind of do a dietary recall. You know, I kind of walk through what their diet looked like before they went gluten-free and what it looks like now. And I look for any micronutrient deficiencies that could be cropping up due to restriction of certain food groups. And I try to make sure that the diet is overall balanced and still one that can help them maintain the rest of their health goals outside of just the celiac disease as well.
And do you have any good resources you recommend to patients on a gluten-free diet to sort of help them when you're not around to help them?
Yeah. A lot of the times, we can't be with patients while they're shopping. And unfortunately, I wish I could because I think it would be a really helpful experience. But there's certain apps like the Gluten-Free Scanner app that you can kind of use to check barcodes. And that'll do a quick kind of, I would say not first check, but double check for patients if the food that they are buying contains any gluten ingredients. There's a Find Me Gluten-Free app that's almost like, I like to describe it like Yelp for people with celiac disease, because it'll rate these restaurants. A lot of people with celiac disease will rate these restaurants based on how good they feel these restaurants do with principles like cross-contact and if they feel that they got any gluten exposure at the restaurant. So that can be a great tool for not only finding restaurants near locally, but also when traveling as well. Celiac.org is another great organization, and they have a lot of resources, recipes online that patients can look at. And then I always like to plug in just local patient support groups, because talking with patients who have had celiac disease for a long time is very helpful for new patients to try to figure out, okay, you know, what restaurants in my area do other people with celiac disease tend to recommend or trust? And what restaurants, but also grocery stores in the area, carry a good variety of gluten-free products at an affordable price. So those are some of the resources I tend to recommend to patients on a gluten-free diet.
Thank you all of you for just such a wonderful dialogue. I know that I have learned a lot myself, and hearing from the experts as well as an expert who's also as a patient is a first for our podcast. So we really appreciate that. On behalf of the team, thank you to our special guests for your expertise, wisdom, and insights. Additionally, we want to thank Dr. Payne as our resident host who developed and vetted the content for today's episode. I certainly enjoyed this time with you all and imagine that many of our listeners will find the information illuminating and essential in their practice and in their careers. So thank you also to the Cleveland Clinic Education Institute for the educational support of this project and this show. Until next time, please enjoy this and future podcasts during our next Medicine Grand Rounders.